Sorry for the delays. This is lecture three in the series of hopefully three lectures, possibly four, not sure yet. I know you were at the others. Who else? Were you at any of the other lectures?
Previous lectures?
Yeah, did you come to any of the previous lectures?
On the first attempt.
Okay, and you? Same?
Second
time?
Yeah.
Okay. I will attempt a quick overview. So, there you go. So, weird fiction. It is a particular genre of fiction from the 1920s. Or it became recognized in the 1920s. It is strongly associated with magazines, short story magazines of adventure and science and magic that appeared in America, the UK, some other countries in the 1920s. It's particularly associated with these authors, H.P. Lovecraft, and a magazine called Weird Tales. And it's before the genres of science fiction and fantasy and mystery and horror separated into distinct categories. So at this time, people were quite happily mixing all of those stories together.
Yes.
It tends to involve short stories focusing on atmosphere and impressions rather than on the plot or explaining things. It's trying to create a sense of strangeness and leave you wondering about things after the story has finished. What was really going on? What was happening? Did that really happen? And there are some common themes, like tomes, old books full of mysteries and secrets, and tentacles, strange monsters not taken from traditional folklore or ghost stories, but things that are supposed to be alien, that are completely new to humans. And these are the magazines where people were exploring these things. And you have stories about a wizard using plants to control people, some kind of demon puppet show, and robots, and aliens, and all these things in the same magazines. And there were particular writers who wrote a lot of stories for these, stayed in touch with each other, shared stories, explored ideas together, and sometimes wrote stories that followed each other. So they built up some shared ideas together. And this is sometimes called the Lovecraft Circle. And here are some of the main writers. You might recognize some of them, you might not. Lovecraft invented Cthulhu and lots of things with tentacles. Robert E. Howard was Conan, so Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Barbarian. You may be familiar with that. These others, Robert Bloch became a Hollywood author of horror, like Psycho. And these others all had their own literary careers. I covered a lot of the history before, so now we're looking at the end of this original period of weird fiction. So in the 1940s, most weird fiction is published in what's called pulp magazines, these very cheap magazines, because the cost of the pulp paper was very low. But during the Second World War, there were paper shortages, which meant the price of paper rose dramatically. These magazines, the economy depended on selling lots of copies cheaply. They weren't for wealthy people who were very literary. They were for ordinary working people who wanted something fun and interesting to read. And that was no longer possible. They couldn't afford to buy the magazines with the increasing costs. So lots of these magazines collapsed. They disappeared. They stopped publication. After the war, especially in America, people started to be wealthier. And there was this change in fashion for modern magazines. So high quality, colour, glossy paper, the shiny paper, lots of photographs, lots of illustrations. And they were trying to market themselves as being mature, sophisticated magazines for grown-ups, not like those old stories for children. And they tended to write more realistic stories. And now I say realistic, they might be the impossible adventures of soldiers, for example.
Soldiers.
Yeah, so it might be a story about how I defeated 500 Germans using this bottle instead of about fighting a demon. So Weird Tales might tell you about adventures with a demon. The new magazines might tell you these war stories that are completely impossible, but they are presented in a more realistic way. That the stories say, oh, this really happened. This is a real thing. This manly man had these heroic adventures. And so the fashion is now in favor of less fantastical stories. Not so many ghosts, not so many aliens and monsters and magic. And at the same time, television is really becoming a big medium. Comic books are starting to become very popular, and that competes especially for the younger audience, teenagers, children. And cheap books are becoming available, paperback books. So there's a lot of competition for this audience of low-cost, popular material. And the pulp magazines cannot compete with it. There's too many changes. And most of them just collapse. They stop publishing entirely. Because the pulps disappear, they are the main people publishing these weird short stories. And essentially in the West, the genre completely disappears. It's just not available as a... You can't go into shops and find magazines of weird stories anymore. Now in some countries, that doesn't happen. So in India, in some African countries, I know there was still a market of pulp magazines because the same economic changes had not happened. The same changes in fashion had not happened. And particularly things like on railway journeys, these kind of stories were really popular for long journeys. So you would sit and you would read these incredible stories to your friends or your family. A second thing that happened was that because these things were published on these very cheap, low-quality paper, they didn't survive very well. They weren't in books, they weren't on high quality paper, so they were burned or thrown away or they fell apart. And so there weren't lots of copies of these stories in libraries or archives. Only a few people were still keeping the copies of these stories. And so they disappeared from circulation. People were just not able to find them or to read them. And a big part of this is the prestige. If something is considered to be literature, people work to preserve it. But what we call genre fiction, all this science fiction, fantasy, romance, all these things, that's low status. And people weren't interested in preserving it. There's always rubbish. You don't need to preserve that stuff. And as a result, Nobody's seeing these stories, so the stories and the authors are mostly forgotten. Mostly. And the people who were writing weird fiction originally start to move into other genres to maintain their careers. So you get people writing literary fiction. So up at the top you have originally people who might be writing in weird tales, for example. And on one hand, people start to write in more high-status literary forms. Literary weird fiction. For example, I don't know the Chinese version, but Murakami Haruki, like South of the Border, West of the Sun, a famous Japanese author. But so people who write these serious literature, but strange. So some people start moving away from popular weird stories and into this very literary, high status fiction. Some people move into this new form that's called magical realism, very popular in Latin America, Spanish authors, and some other countries. And that's again a literary form, it's high status. It's only read by a limited number of people. And on the other side, the people that were writing this mixed up weird fiction start to separate into specific genres. You're not writing strange stories about everything anymore, you just write horror stories about ghosts and werewolves and murderers. Or you just write fantasy about swords and magic. Or you just write science fiction. Because the magazines are becoming more specialised. The books are becoming more specialised. And you can have a much better career if you're only writing one type of fiction and you have a strong reputation for it.
Yeah.
So everyone becomes more specialised, and only a few people can still maintain this very general, weird fiction. There are a few people surviving. A company called Arkham House was set up specifically to keep reprinting pulp stories, particularly stories of Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft. It was set up by his heirs, the people who were looking after his will after he died. And they were trying to republish these stories as books and keep them available. And also publishing new stories by some of the same authors or people they influenced. So some of the former authors from Weird Tales are still publishing there. Again, you see the same names. Robert Bloch. Ramsey Campbell is a new one. Frank Belknap Long. August Derleth, who was running the company and also publishing. And you have new authors coming in, taking those ideas but writing in their own style. Mervyn Peake, who I'll talk about later. Philip K. Dick wrote very strange science fiction. Basically, Blade Runner. Do you know Blade Runner?
No.
I don't know I don't know the Chinese name, but I'm almost certain if you watch films that you know about Blade Runner. Michael Moorcock, who wrote kind of fantasy stories, but about lots of realities all mixing with each other, and history, different versions of history mixing together. So also very strange. So I'm going to talk for a bit about Mervyn Peake, because in this period after the 40s, he is one of the big influential new authors who kept this this field alive. He wrote a series called Gormenghast. It's the only thing he wrote, really. And it is a classic. In the English-speaking world, almost everyone has heard of it. Almost nobody has read it. So it's very famous, but I haven't read all of it. And it has been described accurately as very, very strange indeed. It is grown out of the Gothic form of literature,
So, do you know things like Wuthering Heights, The Woman in White, some of these older films, even things like Frankenstein or Dracula? It has evolved from those kinds of stories, but much less supernatural and much stranger. It's basically a fantasy story, but it doesn't have magic, it doesn't have monsters. It's about humans, but in this very exaggerated reality, where everything is exaggerated into caricatures that are funny, but also kind of disturbing. Hello, you can come in. It's this isolated castle with a small number of people still living a very, very traditional life after the world has changed, going mad and plotting against each other. So there's mysteries and there's drama, there's murders, and everyone is very strange. All of the characters are very, very exaggerated. So, for example, the castle they live in is impossibly big. It's like if you had a building that was the size of Xi'an. The description of the castle is so huge. All of the characters, they have a particular trait, like a tobian, but you magnify it 1,000 times. The doctor is... Dr. Prune Squalor, with his hyena laugh, his bizarre and elegant body, his celluloid face. His main defects? The insufferable pitch of his voice, his maddening laughter, and his affected gestures. So he doesn't just have an annoying laugh. He laughs in a way that almost makes people feel mad. And someone doesn't just move in a slightly strange way. They move and their head turns like a snake. And all of these descriptions of everyone is always very, very strong. The cook, who is like a king in this boiling hot kitchen, is described almost as though he's a giant. He's a huge person with a huge personality. So there's all of this. And while the servants in a noble house tend to have their own political struggles, they want to get a promotion and get a better position. But in Gormenghast, they're secretly trying to make each other go mad, or they're plotting to murder each other, or they're wandering around the castle like some kind of animals and acting almost as though they're not humans. They're behaving like ghosts or monsters. And the life of all the people in this castle is completely controlled by ceremonies, by rituals, that nobody even remembers what they're for, why anyone does them. And there's this sense that you are being suffocated. Oh, it's 10 o'clock, we have to go and stand in the courtyard for 20 minutes and shout, and then come back in. Why? We always do. This kind of thing. It's very much, we have to do this because we have always done it. Nobody knows why, but we have to do it. And everyone is feeling like they go mad because nothing makes sense. And a lot of what he's doing is exploring this idea of different ways that people can be evil, or people can be pushed into doing things that are evil. So, who is this Mervyn Peake? Well, he's actually, although he's a Westerner, he grew up and was born in Imperial China. And it was a really big influence on his life and on his writing. He was really familiar with the architectural styles, with the... Of course, he doesn't have a native understanding, but he is familiar with the social structures of Imperial China.
with the kind of ritual behaviour, the particular rules of etiquette and politeness. And because his family connections, he would have had some contact with the nobility of Imperial China and understood how some of these things worked. The castle, Gormenghast Castle, was inspired by the Forbidden City, which obviously he knew about. This huge, a town that was a city, that was a castle. The people almost never going outside, living in their own world, with their own rules about how everything works. It was a big inspiration for that. And, of course, another big influence was the British Empire, the British aristocracy and their strange habits, the things they were allowed to do because they were nobility, the things people put up with because it had always been that way. He was also involved in World War II. He wrote a lot of his stories during the war, and he published them shortly afterwards. And he had a lot of experience of the war. He was a photographer, so he, as well as being in the war, he also was sent to photograph battles, concentration camps. So when they found the German concentration camps, he was sent in to photograph them, which is obviously a horrific experience. All of the people who've been tortured and killed. But also the very strange life of being a soldier, where half the time you're incredibly bored and half the time you're in danger of dying. And a lot of the time you're controlled by rules made by people hundreds of miles away that you don't even really understand. Oh, we go there because someone says we go there. So these were all influences. And his work addresses a lot of social themes. So all these traditions of the castle are pointless, and they're often cruel. They're damaging to all the people involved. Particular people are controlled or are not allowed to do things. But the characters who are trying to change that also don't have good solutions. They don't have good ideas for how to fix it. So one of the servants, called Steerpike, tries to escape from this formality and all these rituals by becoming powerful himself. He wants to become the chief servant. And he plots and murders and gets rid of other servants to try and achieve that, using violence and lies. And you can see in his career a parallel to the way that the Nazis rose to power, exploiting the idea that the old traditions were bad and oppressive to ordinary people, but at the same time abusing people's agreement with those ideas, seeking power for its own sake, using violence, using deception, and bringing disaster to everyone, which is exactly what happens with Steerpike. And he basically is criticizing the imperialism that he's familiar with from his own culture and to some extent from China, obviously at this point China is changing, but also the fascism that has risen up to say, oh, the old British European aristocracy are wrong, but is bringing something terrible to replace it with. He's saying all of these ideas are bad. And his work was a big influence on writers of a new literary movement that would follow, which is called New Weird. The big problem is that his books are very long. The writing is very dense, lots and lots of words and descriptions. And it can be very hard to read, unfortunately. But there has been a BBC adaptation. This is that servant, Steerpike, and this is the castle. You can see it's this bizarre, huge mixture of different buildings just crammed together. And you can see he's not very normal, just by looking at this picture. And we have some of the illustrations from the original book. Here's the cook. Gigantic, huge cook. And two of the noble women, enormous chins and noses. So like I said, everything is a caricature, an exaggeration. And this is just a description from it. The madness is illusory and control never falters. It is, if you like, a rich wine of fancy, chilled by the intellect, just the right temperature. There is no really close relative to it in all our prose literature. It is uniquely brilliant, and we are right to call it a modern classic. And that's by Anthony Burgess, who is another famous writer. And this is a selection from the text, which I won't read out, it's quite long. You can see all of the descriptions. He's talking about how this person's face is so bony that it seems like instead of words, he would speak stones. And whenever he moves, there's a cracking sound like he's breaking wood, breaking twigs. So everything about these descriptions are very exaggerated, very dramatic. Ramsay Campbell is another one of these writers. Somewhat less strange. He's considered one of the leading modern horror writers. So he's very much horror, not just weird fiction. He was very heavily influenced by the pulp fiction writers, particularly Lovecraft. And he started and continued writing in that period when there was very little weird fiction. He managed to make contact with August Derleth, the Arkham House owner, and Derleth essentially mentored him and tutored him to help him improve his writing. So as a result, Campbell was able to get his work published and continue developing a career in weird writing and in horror. Unlike most of these authors, he drew very heavily on real places to create atmosphere. In his case, Campbell was using Liverpool, his hometown, also my hometown, as one of the main sources of inspiration. So what were the buildings like? What were the people like? What was the history? And he also created a fictional version of Southwest England, a set of valleys and villages to set a lot of his horror stories, which is the same thing that Lovecraft did in Northeastern America. A fictional New England. After his first few stories, he made a deliberate effort to get away from the influence of Lovecraft and develop his own style, which he managed quite successfully. He was deliberately drawing on literary novelists, Iris Murdoch, Graham Greene, Nabokov. And he has written a huge amount of stuff. He's got 30 novels, hundreds of short stories, and there are 3 films of his work. He's also a film critic, and he has won dozens of awards, which is why he's considered to be one of these really influential writers. He tends to write stories about things like madness, possession. What does it mean to be evil? And he does draw a lot of inspiration from films and from the techniques of films. Another point of similarity with Lovecraft is that his interest in things like madness is strongly related to the fact that his mother developed a very severe mental illness, just as Lovecraft's mother did. And so both of them had a very personal exposure to the changes in people's minds, the changes in behaviour, and the way that could make people feel. And to some extent, you can see his writing as being helping him to deal with that experience. He's got a strong interest in using real-world elements to try and create this sense of supernatural events or disturbing things. And as a result, he's tended to move away from a lot of the very traditional stories are based on one lonely house somewhere or a small village somewhere where terrible things happen. And Ramsay Campbell tends to try and deliberately look at more modern elements. So he's written horror stories based on the internet, for example, and stage mediums, which I've... This one. Which I can't pronounce. But so stories about these kinds of much more modern phenomena, trying to make modern forms of horror that relate to people's experiences and not to events of hundreds of years ago that seem too distant. And again, it's quite different from the kind of monsters and ghosts that you tend to get in traditional pulp horror. And let's have a brief break, because I have kept you here for a long time. So if we take about 5 minutes, and then I'll... Sorry, I've been trying to catch up on... Because we started late, so I was trying to catch up on the first part of the lecture. Oh, I've just realised I haven't been using the microphone. Never mind. Could you actually hear me? Okay. That's reassuring. Yeah. Does anyone have any questions?
Questions? Do we have any questions?
So, I want to know about Ben Marquis of Moyen is the writer of weird fiction. Because they are the representative of realistic magical realism.
Mm-hmm.
So they are the writers of this of the weird fiction.
It basically depends who you ask. So some people will say magical realism is a form of weird fiction.
Yeah.
And some people like to be much more specific and say this one is magical realism and that one is weird fiction, and we're going to keep them separate.
Oh yes.
So I think you can take either approach, and it depends what you want to talk about.
Thank you.
Okay. We can talk about this properly for a long time.
Yes. Okay, that's right.
Okay, let's see how much more of this lecture I can get through. There may have to be a fourth lecture. Does anyone have any more questions that you've thought of during the break? No? Good. So, a quick summary. There was weird fiction, then it died. Now it's coming back. So, in the late 20th century, so 1970s, you start to see, after a gap of about 30 to 40 years, you start to see weird fiction slowly growing back into a more popular genre. And a big part of this is role-playing. Role-playing games, specifically, obviously, this time, these games appear, so Dungeons and Dragons is the one you might have heard of. But pulp is actually a big inspiration from these. What happens is you've got an existing hobby of historical battles, so people recreating battles using small model armies. It's been done for hundreds of years. But now you have this idea of having very small groups of people and treating them like the heroes of adventure stories. These are role-playing games. Instead of having 1,000 soldiers, you have 5. And they're all characters from Lord of the Rings or from King Arthur or these kinds of people. And they're all fantastical. Because the people doing this are the people that coming up with these ideas are fans of pulp literature. They like their fantasy. They like their weird fiction, their science. Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson, the people who are kind of driving this, grew up reading pulp magazines. And so that's a big influence for them. And when they're creating these games, they just put in everything that they enjoy. They're doing it for their own friends, for their own enjoyment. So if you want some aliens and some robots and some dragons and some strange squid creatures, yeah, you can do that. Whatever you like. Wizards, yeah, sure. They just put in everything. Another advantage was that because weird fiction was mostly from the 1920s, by the 1970s, a lot of it was no longer in copyright, which meant when they started publishing these games for profit, instead of just playing them at home, you could use all of that material. A lot of later science fiction and fantasy was still in copyright. You would have had to pay enormous fees to use it. But stuff from the 1920s, that was available. You could just use it. You could just say, I'm going to put that in my game. And so they did. You had Dungeons and Dragons, but you also ended up with something called the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. And that is specifically based on weird fiction. It was inspired by H.P. Lovecraft and August Derleth and other people writing mysterious, weird stories. And whereas Dungeons and Dragons was about running into castles and fighting monsters, Call of Cthulhu was about exploring strange situations, ghost stories or disappearances or strange noises, and finding out bizarre things, maybe going mad, maybe being kidnapped by aliens, all kinds of things. And on the left here, we've got an illustration of Cthulhu from Lovecraft Stories, Great Cthulhu. We have a picture of, sorry about the quality, but this is a picture from Cthulhu who was specifically included in the very first version of Dungeons and Dragons as one of the creatures you might encounter as a hero. And in a very recent version, you have here a picture of something called a Mind Flayer. You may notice the similarity. It's basically Cthulhu. They're the same. So they've been incorporated directly into the stories. There is a game of Call of Cthulhu. You may recognise the handsome gentleman on the left. This was a couple of years ago. And so it's a much more minority hobby these days. It was very popular for about 30 years. Less than that. 20 years, maybe. But it was very popular for a short time. Its popularity dropped a bit. You had computers and things competing. Once you started having computers, lots of board games, lots of card games, lots of colourful TV for people to watch, the popularity of tabletop role-playing decreased. But in that time, it had had a big influence. People were playing with their families and with their friends, and things were easily available in the shops. And one of the things that did was it exposed people to those authors and to those stories. People started to look for who wrote all these books that were listed in the back of the games as inspiration, because Dungeons and Dragons in particular had a big list saying these are the books that gave us the idea for this game, called Appendix N, and people went looking for those stories. People started republishing them to try and meet that demand, and people who were playing these games started to be inspired by it when they wanted to write their own stories. They wrote about the experiences they'd had playing games about these weird stories. So you got this cycle going. At the same time, we had the internet arising, the 80s, 90s, and it became much more simple to get hold of those out-of-print books, either to buy copies from a bookshop in another country, even, or to advertise that you were selling it and find someone else who wanted to buy it instead of throwing it away, or for people to start publishing those stories online for free. People who were fans or people who were librarians started to make some of these stories available. And let's also be honest, there was a big overlap between the people who were involved in the early internet and the kind of people who like science fiction and fantasy stories and weird fiction, because they're all nerds. Hey, I'm a nerd, no shame. People who are really interested in computing and IT are often also interested in genre fiction. And so you had the people who were setting up online communities and talking about the internet in the early days, talking about computing, were also sharing the books they were fans of. They were saying, you should check out this author. And also at that time, you had this big age range of people who were older experts in computer science, who were maybe the technical experts who were setting up and trying a lot of these things, and younger enthusiasts who wanted to learn all about computers, all about technology, who were meeting them in these online sites, very early forms of social media, and being told about these authors that the older people had read when they were young. So again, you get this word of mouth advertising. And finally, you got a change in approach in literary studies at universities, in papers, where people started to accept genre fiction as literature. They started to accept that it was actually perfectly reasonable to study fantasy fiction, to study science fiction, and that you could learn things about people. It did have patterns, it did have value as a source of study. So genre literature starts appearing on the syllabus at universities, at schools, and therefore more people are exposed to it. And at the same time, you get academics talking about these things, not just in very, very small journals for fans of a particular author, but in general academic journals. And so there's this big combination of factors that helps to revive the genre and interest in it. So there's kind of an explosion. And between these things, you get a big market emerges. Between ebooks and print on demand publishing, authors are able to start sustaining a career in this small genre in ways they previously couldn't, and so you get more people writing these things. The advantage of ebooks and online is, first of all, it's much cheaper to publish ebooks, you don't need to store them. And also, if you're writing an ebook in Xi'an, you can sell it to people in America with no effort. But if you were doing that now, even if you write it in, before the internet, even if you're writing it in English, people in America don't know you've published it. It's really hard to advertise. It's really hard to send it to them by post. So it becomes much easier. Your market is much, much bigger than it would have been with just paper books. And so that means if you write in a very small genre, you can reach audiences all across the world and still make enough sales to support your career. And at the moment, honestly, the market seems to be very much insatiable. Whatever you write or produce, people will buy it. There are books and TV shows and games, and a lot of them are tied to these very old established names. Something, something, Lovecraft, something. Arkham, Cthulhu. Cthulhu is on lots of things. The name. You've got some newer things appearing, like an online game called Fallen London, which is it's a browser game about exploring an imaginary version of London that has been taken underground by devils. And it doesn't really have a plot, but it's about interacting and having a strange atmosphere. And that, according to critics, makes it part of weird fiction. You've got lots of short films, either people filming old weird stories or people making their own, some of which I've seen. Cthulhu has become, in the West, I don't know about China, but is just part of the mainstream pop culture. Cthulhu is all over the internet. He's in books, he's in movies, lots of games. He appears in TV shows like South Park, on clothes, toys. There are parody songs about Cthulhu. So comic songs. You've got cute Cthulhus, Cthulhu beds, t-shirts.
Nice.
You get the idea. And hopefully, this is Fallen London. So that is Fallen London. And you've got things which are more just influenced by it. Obviously, Cthulhu, you see Cthulhu all over the place. You've got Night Vale, which I'll, on the bottom right, which I'll show you later. Carcosa. Other.
If you like listening to Welcome to Night Vale, there's a really good chance you'll like seeing it live on stage. Well, I've got great news. Our brand new live show, A Spy in the Desert, is heading to the UK and Europe early 2019. Plus, we've got a ton of great US dates coming up for all you Americans out there, including two shows in Seattle on January 18th. That is the night before PodCon 2. This live show is all about spies and secrets and features some audience interaction that we've never tried before. I think you're going to love it. And even if you're not caught up on the podcast, it doesn't matter. You don't need to be. Check out the full list of cities at welcometonightville.com/live and get your tickets today.
Southern California is synonymous with driving. And since you can expect to put a lot of miles on your car each day, MPGs matter. So Toyota offers a full line of fuel-efficient hybrid cars. What? Leading the way is...
Okay, that's just being annoying. I wanted to play you... That's just adverts. I wanted to play you a sample from Welcome to Night Vale, which is a weird podcast, so a radio show. based on ideas from weird fiction, but very, very different. It's about a very weird town in the middle of America, the rural parts, where everything is just very strange. Daily life is very, very strange, and just the everyday events of that town. And we've got a few minutes. Does anyone have any questions, or do you want me to move on? Any questions? No. Okay. Let's see what we can do. Okay. The New Weird. This describes itself as a more postmodern approach to weird fiction. So doing the same thing, thinking about atmosphere and making people feel unsettled and wondering about things without worrying about genre boundaries, but trying to take the cliches of older forms of weird fiction and undermine them. A lot of fantasy and science fiction is often seen as being utopian. So it's about how great things are, or how great they can become. If you think about fantasy stories, a lot of the time, people defeat the evil king and then everything is great. Or people go into space and they build a new working society and overcome their problems. And things are better. And so New Weird typically is about challenging that idea and suggesting that it's not going to be that easy. So you've got people like China Mieville, who uses fantasy and industrialization as his topics. Thomas Ligotti, who has this very pessimistic kind of horror. Justina Robson, who writes all about parallel dimensions and magic and different forms of sources of power. Caitlin R. Kiernan, just this idea that you can't really have connections between people, and that no matter how well you think you know things, there are always aspects of them that you cannot know, but that you deeply want to understand them, to make connections with. This is China Mieville. He said he wants to write a novel in every genre. And he tends to write in ways that he's deliberately trying to ignore the normal restrictions on a genre. Although it's been pointed out, no matter what genre he's writing in, he's always fantastical, he's always surreal. So you have things like The City and the City, where you have there's one city and the population is divided in two, and they're brainwashed so that if you belong to part A, you can't even notice people that belong to part B, even when you walk past them in the street. You simply don't acknowledge them. This incredibly strange setup. You've got Railsea, which is a world that is completely filled with railways and monsters, and the only safe way to travel between cities is on trains through this endless, endless railway. And he was influenced a lot by weird fiction authors, including Lovecraft and Marvin Peake, but he was also heavily influenced by Dungeons and Dragons. He said as much. And he tends to use a lot of rules. So if there is magic in his world, there are systems for how it works. If there are gods in his world, there are systems and rules for how they work. And that, he said, is very, very heavily influenced by playing role-playing games. He's a socialist. He's got a PhD in Marxism, and he's written about the Russian Revolution as well. And his left-wing ideas do influence his writing, although he does say what he writes isn't deliberately political. That's just a natural part of writing. If you write anything, it's automatically political to some extent. And then you've got the way that weird fiction has influenced things that aren't really weird fiction. The designs of monsters in a lot of modern monster shows, monster films, borrows from these ideas of tentacles and eyes and insect features and slime, and that came from even Alien, the classic Alien, borrowed ideas from weird fiction. The whole genre of paranormal things like X-Files or Stranger Things or True Detective. And then you've got, here's a big old list of films. The Mist, Event Horizon, Prometheus, The Thing, Arrival. I don't know if anyone saw that. It was a few years ago now, but it's about aliens and language. And Pan's Labyrinth, which is a fantastical story, but is also about the Nazis in World War II. And you've got even people like Philip Pullman, who thinks he writes fantasy stories for children, but actually a lot of the ideas in them are a very strange mixture of aspects that you could easily connect with weird fiction. I'm really not going to have time to go through all of these things in any detail. I think it might be better if we sort of end it there and you just let me know if you have any questions. And I may do a fourth lecture, I'm not sure. Because there's no way we can do it in 5 minutes. Yeah, I've got another 20 slides. So, any questions? Any comments?
What are the values of those weird fiction?
Values?
It could bring sensation or shocking effect to people, but after that, what can the readers carry away?
It depends a lot on which bit of weird fiction you're reading. So some of them are purely for entertainment. It's just enjoyable. And a lot of the pulp weird is designed for that. Some of it sets out to explore. So Ramsey Campbell, as I said, or Merlin Peak both use it to explore ideas of what is normal, what is not normal, how do humans end up doing things that are evil, what are the influences that affect human behaviour in ways that we will consider to be evil. There's some modern weird fiction that uses it to look at issues like racism. So it could be somewhere later on in this, but so one of the things that weird fiction often does is it uses, particularly monsters, but it uses these supernatural elements as this idea of other, things that are not like us. You know, it could be monsters or ghosts or other strange things. And historically, that idea has also been used a lot in racism, either deliberately or just in the way people talk about people from other cultures or people from other races, as though they're fundamentally different. And so there are people who use weird fiction to explore those ideas, what makes us different from things that we consider other. In what ways are we the same as things that initially seem shocking, and that kind of thing. Some of it, as I've mentioned, is dealing with themes like identity, madness, so how does changing mental state
affect who a person is. And you know, at what point does someone stop being who they are? If they're suffering from, for example, dementia, Alzheimer's disease, these kind of things you can't recover from that damage your mind, or the way illness can change a person, just ordinary illness can transform what someone can do or the way they live, and how that affects the people around them. So they can be, they can relate to a wider range of things that kind of make you think. But yes, a lot of it is, like any genre, I suppose, a lot of it is basically to entertain you. And if you come away thinking deeply about something, that's a coincidence. not necessarily the original point.
I have a question. Are there any standards to decide whether a fiction is good or not, or we judge them only by popularity?
I think you've got to judge it by yourself, to be honest. Because it's quite a broad genre, it's not always clear what the author is trying to do. So a lot of the time it's trying to make you, when you finish reading it, you're going, but what was really going on? And just really thinking and wondering about it. That's quite often what they're trying to do. And so you could say, if that's what happens, then they've succeeded. But equally, you might be doing that and not enjoying it. So, I don't know if you can. I can't give you an objective standard.
And do you think, or will it ever become a kind of distant literature than with fiction? Will it become, do you think, how long will it take, or will it ever become a kind of decent literature, in the so-called decent literature?
Do you mean in the sense of high status?
Yes.
I think you could argue that it already has. It's just that it gets different names. So, as I was saying, you've got things like. So you could say that Haruki Murakami is literary weird fiction. Some of these things. Arrival is a kind of high status literary claims movie, and it's weird fiction, but it wouldn't be called that. And some magical realism, again, you could say, is that really not? What's different between that and weird fiction? So maybe.
I've been watching a series, I think, a Game of Thrones, you know. It is a kind of weird fiction, or is it a fantasy?
I think I would just call it straightforward fantasy. It may well have some influences from particular bits of weird fiction, but I haven't seen it or read it, but from what I know about the series, it's not about atmosphere, it's not about creating that sense of mystery and wondering, and so it wouldn't really fall into the category of weird fiction.
After watching that, I know what is going on, so that is not weird fiction.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you for my answers.
You must read not all weird fiction books. Is there any interesting magic fiction books to us?
Are you looking for recommendations?
Yeah.
Okay. Have me on WeChat. I have a Wii U folder, which has recordings of these lectures, but also it has some stories that I've uploaded, a small library of weird fiction. So I can give you access to that.
Sure.
Yeah.
We chat.
Yeah, you can finish that me. I will add you to my Way of Fiction Lectures group.
Yes, thank you.
If you want to be happy, let me know if you want to be added to the group. I also have recordings of the two previous lectures. So if you do want to see what was in the And I'll keep adding things to that collection as well. So, and if anyone has suggestions for what other things to add to it, of course, you know, I'm happy to take recommendations, particularly if there's any Chinese stories you think should be added. Because my ability to read Chinese is so poor that I haven't read any Chinese literature. Should all have now been added to the lectures group. Have I missed anyone?
Yeah. Wow.
Send the link to Wayin, because I don't have it with me right now. But I'll send the link to the special Wayin for that I have. I'll upload the slides and the recording from this lecture. And if I end up doing lecture 4, so because as well as this part, I also have a section about non-English and international weird fiction. So there may be a lecture 4 in this series, I'm not sure.
So what's your speech next time? Will you know?
next
semester?
I don't know yet. I don't know if I'm allowed to keep talking about weird fiction or if I have to speak about something else. So it depends on what Dr. is going to tell me. We'll see. I may have to find another topic. I may also repeat the lectures from this semester, in case any. So hopefully next semester I'll be living on this campus, in which case it'll be easier for me to give lectures. So I may repeat some of them, as well as doing new ones.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But when I know, I'll let you know. Yeah, at the moment I don't know. So yeah, I might do some on something like individual stories or some particular authors, or I may speak about another topic like
yes.
Celtic languages or Mesopotamian gods or.
Yeah, yes, it will be very less.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Bye, lecture.
That's okay. All right, well, have a lovely day and happy new year.
Thank you. Thank
you. 新年快乐.
Okay, I should turn this off.